Okay. Since we're all back, we have been asked to do a group picture. So you're going to do a picture before people have, because
I'll stand up here and you can just mingle in and I'll get it.
You taking a picture?
Yeah, for everyone.
Do we have to kind of get...
Yeah, we should come.
I'll give you this. How should we do it? Oh, wait, what about you?
Well, so I'll get a selfie with someone.
I'll get a selfie.
You can take a turn and get yourself in it.
All right.
Can you get yourself in it?
I can't. This way. Well, all right. Everyone, one, two, three. Oh, that's great. You're going to like that.
Okay. Right, now wait to have somebody else take that.
Yeah,
oh, wait.
Okay.
All right. I'll do it.
I'll stand.
Or try it. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, young people know how to do these.
Yes, they do.
They certainly do them all the time. Of course, we don't get Jim either. I bet you didn't take the
chair. Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
You were good.
Yeah.
You should stand up on a chair.
You
can get it all.
In fact,
you just did a better shot.
All right, you guys ready?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
So, all right, we good?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
So everybody gets to listen.
You're doing
to
that.
Yeah,
what?
Okay.
You have to have a copy of that. I'm
going
to give you my number.
Yeah. I don't know if you could stick it on a Google group for that.
I wondered.
Are you going to send it, please? Huh? Good at you.
Okay.
She's, you got to write it
down. Back to serious
work here.
So, we're going to keep on now, especially since Tanji would like a little consultation. Okay, so what is the goal with grief and loss? Like anybody else, we start by setting goals for therapy. And you got to be careful, because guess what? A lot of people, when they're having trouble with grief, they want it to go away. Hmm. They want it to be done. So you need to really talk with them about, and you know, what is the goal to make the feelings go away, to get through grief as quickly as possible? You really need to look at, you know, and work with the person to come up with goals that actually are realistic and doable. And that is going to depend on the person, but you know, making it go really honestly, whenever people say I should feel, or I need to feel this way, I want to be calm, I need to be calm, I need to be this, I need to be that, that's a setup. And similarly, you want to, the person, you know, it's reasonable to be able to work and function well, you know, to be able to enjoy things again, but also go through a healthy process of grief. You don't know. We kind of know what's healthy, so we figure that's what people want, but you got to ask, because people have unrealistic ideas. They feel like, I should be done. And done is not something that happens with grief. It could pop up. You know, they do things after a year, up to a year, but culturally you can. But, you know, 10 years later something can pop up. That's not unhealthy. That's not unnatural. Yeah.
How would you do that? Would that be a psychoeducational way? I mean, how do you do that in terms of guided discussion?
Well, first, when the person comes in, as always, we ask, what would you like to accomplish here? And what would it look like? I always ask, I always do the question thing. Say, we're ending treatment, you're shaking my hand, and you're saying, thank you so much, Dr. Fleming, I got exactly what I wanted. What does it look like? And you discuss that process. And then, yes, what you do then, weave in, always, in the setting goals with anyone, you have to weave in some psychoeducation about, yes, of course I understand that you never want to have another panic attack, or you don't ever want to feel sad. And honestly, if I could do that, I would be glad to help you with that. But that's not human. That's not feasible. We have feelings. We have a lot of feelings. And so, it doesn't go away. And in fact, by trying to make it go away, often makes it less likely to go away. So let's then talk about what is the normal grief process. You know, what realistically could we compromise on? It's pretty much the same with any patient coming in saying, you know, I want to be able to drink as much as I want and abuse the alcohol, but still have a rich, full, satisfying life. Okay. I will give some handouts. I'll talk about, let's look at what's getting in the way for you. Let's look at what is causing, and you need, it's going to be different. What brings the person to you? What about their grief is causing them a problem? And that's going to tell you a lot about what you need to do to, as far as integration. Now, if they are avoiding, which is often the case, and even when the person's dwelling, often they're dwelling in a way that's avoiding other aspects. You know, if they're focusing on I should have done something differently, rather but not looking at the loss in their life, they're still avoiding part of it. So they need to, part of our intervention is to promote that elaboration and integration of the loss, to do experiential exposure. Okay, now that can be, and remember, this is all with informed consent. This doesn't have to be flooding. This doesn't have to be the person can move towards and move back. You know, they can do it in pieces, but they're going to need to confront the story of the death, the finality of the death, the actual death itself, the loss and what that loss means. So Scheer calls it, you know, revisiting, and then it involves exposure and then leaving it alone for a while. So, you know, facing the reality, elaborating on it, but then taking a break. So everybody, you know, and some of it, people will have their own ideas and every patient is different, but they could tell the story. A lot of people need to talk about it. A lot of people, though, haven't talked about it. They could write. She points out about really reliving the most troubling moments. What moments around surrounding the death are the most upsetting? Are there pieces you just haven't been able to bring yourself to think about? You can do imaginal exposure. You can make a tape or a recording to use for homework. Now, the exposure in grief work is not trying to promote habituation. We're not saying, you know, if you go over and over, it'll go away, which often is what happens with anxiety. But it is more to connect with the realities and feel the feelings. And then again, the beauty is with a recording, you can rewind, put it away, and then move on in your day, and then take it back out again. So it can be a natural homework assignment. I often have people, especially what you want to look at is what has the person been avoiding. If they've been sitting every day, every night, they spend the whole evening going over photographs and, you know, sobbing over the loss, they are not avoiding. Look, but there are a lot of people who haven't looked at pictures since their death. It's just too painful, you know. So you might You can have the person bring in pictures into the session. You can, you want to look at what are they doing and what aren't they doing. You know, what are they avoiding and what are they not avoiding? You can have them write or even record a last conversation with the deceased. So there are many people who have things they wanted to say. They could write a letter to the deceased. They could record a conversation. They could say what they wanted to say. There are lots of different ways to do the exposure and help them integrate it into your life. But it's going to involve some experiential exposure if they've been avoiding. And, you know, or with the things they've been avoiding. And motivation can be a problem. This is painful. People don't like pain. It's like, you know, you might have to use motivational interviewing kinds of techniques. I mean, they're obviously, if they're coming to you and having a problem with grief, something's interfering with the normal grief process. And that's what our job is, to assess that and then help intervene with that. So, then after the exposure, you want to make sure to reward the person for going through this difficult process and move towards mindfulness of current reality. Very important. Mindfulness, in other words, they also need help to integrate. You have to add it in with current reality. So in other words, you do the exposure and then they take a break, pat yourself on the back, or they pat themselves on the back, and then engage in something here and now. So it's not all about death. It's, you know, and then look at what pieces are they not engaging in their life. And these are not, I mean, we're not seeing, I mean, people who have, remember, these are people who've had a problem with grieving over a period of time. I mean, if someone just died yesterday, they don't need to be re-engaging with normal life. They can, you know, they can have a period where they're grieving. A year, they need to do, if it's a year and it's not functioning and it's really causing a problem in their life, they need to then be doing some of each. And like I have, I'm seeing this one man right now. It took a while for him, you know, I had to be really specific. He has social anxiety issues separate from the fact that his wife died. But, you know, having his wife dying when someone who has a long history, he's in his late 60s, a long history of social anxiety, that brings up a whole lot, you know, because he didn't have to, he could go, he did everything with his wife, and then it was okay. He could handle that. But even, and he actually came in, he was referred by his physician, who knows me very well, he trained with me centuries ago. And because he had a very specific, he worried about having an accident, and it was growing and growing. But it was really social anxiety, because he was worried that if he needed to go to the bathroom too often, it would be embarrassing. Okay, so it was very specific, and it really didn't have to, you know, do anything to do with the fact that his wife had died. Except, as we started looking at it, his whole life had changed, because now he was doing everything with her and she was the buffer. And things like, I mean, we're not talking dating. We're talking, you know, he wasn't playing golf with the guys. He wasn't, and he was focusing on his bladder. But then as we started looking at the reality, but there's nothing wrong. bladder. It could be, and then we would deal with that too. That doesn't mean you can't play golf. But then it became, you know, so we had to actually do some real motivational interviewing kinds of guided discovery about, you know, why would you want to be able to go do these things? And why would you want to really continue grieving and feeling your feelings, but also over time get out and do some social things? So acceptance, because we're talking about accepting the feelings, accepting the internal experience. And that doesn't mean the reason Shure talks about attachment issues is that you're not giving up your attachment, you're changing your attachment. You can be very attached to someone who's not physically present. You can still, it's not like we lose the person completely. You lose physical manifestation, but you know, you still have that attachment, you still have those memories if you allow that to be part of your integration process. You can, and if you say, I can't think about it because it's too painful, you really do lose that person in more than just their physical presence. You're losing the memories because you're not letting yourself think about them. Yeah.
Did you say that gentleman, he grew the social anxiety as a result of losing his buffer, or he always been little socially?
He had social anxiety all along, but she helped him with avoidance. Except that then it got, see, that's where the grief came in, because he was playing golf with the guys. And that's the problem when you start avoiding, you know, and then he stopped doing other kinds of social, but then if they went out afterwards, they would include the women. You know, I mean, it was the kind of chit-chat. So it you know, it melds with pre-existing conditions, certainly. So the whole idea of, you know, helping them in whatever way they need to do exposure. Not all at once, not flooding, and we're not kicking and having them kicking and screaming, but you have to help them see that, thinking about it, feeling the feelings, and moving on. So he needed to feel his feelings and grieve for his wife. He also needed to play golf. I mean, it wasn't like the first week. You're allowed to take a week off of golf. But the problem is, he was very, this wasn't something he talked about with his physician. It's not one of his early goals. But he had become totally socially isolated. He was home, focusing on his bladder. I mean, it was, you know, and that clearly, he didn't, you know, then when he came up, we had to add to the goals, because he hadn't said his goal was to play golf, but I had to help him with guided discovery, motivational interviewing, to see that sitting home alone was not, and he was also retired, which, you know, as you get older, there is more likelihood of losses, you know, I mean, there can be losses at any age, but boy, I work with a bunch of elderly people, and if you're healthy and stick around for a while, there are losses right and left. I mean, I know some people whose main social life is now going to funerals. It's like, especially if you do it well and have the 1 week and the two, you know, it's like there's something. And your world gets smaller. By the way, preventatively, and this is actually a preventative grief intervention, I am a very firm believer of having friends, activities, and social life with people of all ages. I think if you only, if think about it, if you only hang out with people your age or older, it's not pretty as you get older. I mean, I see a bunch of people now, and because I've been around for a while, I see a bunch of people in their 90s. It's not pretty. If all your friends were older than you, they're gone. Okay? And if they're not dead, they're in, you know, some assisted living and can't go to the movies with you. If you start from the get-go, now this is what I tell my kids, and they really actually have embraced it, that my kids have friends who are young, and they have friends who are old. You know, I have friends my kids' age and younger. And so there's a preventative intervention. If you see people who are, because, you know, if you live long enough, the solution, you know, the only way to avoid it is to die yourself, which, you know, die first, but, you know, we're not going to recommend that. All right. Dysfunctional thinking. Obviously, you want to, in all this, you start with validating the feeling. You never start with saying, well, let's look realistically, this should not, no. You have to validate their feelings of loss. You have to educate them about the, how normal it is to be feeling a lot of feelings. But when you validate, if there are some dysfunctional cognitions that are making the griefs worse, you want to address them. You want to help them not make the feelings go. You know, dysfunctional, you're doing thought sheets isn't going to make the feelings go away. But it can help to get the feelings in proportion to be part of a healthy grief process. Okay? So we're going to use empathy. We're going to use guided discovery. We're going to use behavioral experiments. Like, you know, I started with my guy doing just a little teeny golf, you know, just shooting 8 holes. Is that what it is?
9.
Okay, whatever.
Nine.
He knew. Luckily, he accepted the fact I knew nothing about golf. If I'd said, I might have said 8 holes, and I'm sure you asked me, so. And, you know, I have a sheet here about some of the cognitions. Because people are scared of feelings. And feelings can be really scary. If you've had profound, I think of, there was this, really the early grief experience for my kids and myself was when a 16-year-old, when my son was 16, one, his friend, he was invited to go to the movies with this group of people. And he still is pretty nerdy. He didn't get that you go to be social. He wasn't interested in the movies, so he didn't go. And then there was a car accident, and a 16-year-old girl died. And it was, and they had a memorial service, which was, I have to tell you, before or since, I have never, it was incredible, it was excruciating. It was so painful. It was gorgeous. It was just beautiful, the celebration of this girl's life. But it was excruciating for me, and she wasn't even, you know, she was my kid's friend. And I use it as an example because it was excruciating for everyone there. And her boyfriend, he had been really badly injured in the accident, and no one knew if he was going to make it to the memorial service, and he comes in looking like hell and on crutches. I mean, it was like, but he needed to be there. You know, it was one of these things. But to me, that really, it was so painful. But I remember, that was a bunch of years ago, and I remember it vividly because it was also gorgeous. And it was, I know, it was very, very healing for those people. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, so this is hard work. I guess we need to appreciate with our clients how hard it is and how natural it is to be frightened of it. You know, the thoughts on these cognitions on page 7, I can't stand it. It'll overwhelm me. I'll lose control. That's not an those. That's how it feels. But the truth is, we don't have a choice. We do. I mean, it doesn't feel like you can stand it. But you know, the truth is, we do. We don't have a choice. We do stand it. And if you tell yourself I can't stand it, it will never end. I have to be tough. You end up inadvertently making it worse. And so these are the kinds of thoughts that we can help people with. And, you know, this makes me, you know, it's crazy, I have to be tough, I'm too vulnerable, I shouldn't feel this way. All these thoughts are things that we can directly help them with. And then help them to learn, okay, you can do this in small, you can stand it. Maybe you can stand it better in small pieces. That's okay. But to not feel it at all, we know, has some consequences. Now, you also, you know, so it's not a natural. People don't know that there are advantages to facing your feelings. I mean, something, we can't just lecture. We have to help them see what's not working in the way you're doing it. What are some alternatives? And is it worth giving some of those a try? Manageable. And always you want to add in, if you're going to do exposure, make sure you then have them engage in something, some mindfulness of the present moment. So do something that they enjoy. And if they haven't been doing things, I mean, it doesn't have to be social, but, you know, make sure you talk with them also about what they could do besides grieving and how they could engage. And just like when I'm doing wallow time with a patient with OCD, you know, we have them exposed, you know, maybe dig their hands in dirt. But after they've done the exposure and, you know, they've finished their homework or wallow in their, you know, obsessive thinking, and then go make dinner or the kids come home, you know, plan to have something else, not to avoid, but to also be mindful of other aspects of life. So you've got to build both in. There may be a lot of people ruminate about why the death occurred, there, you know, whether I could have done this, I could, and it becomes, it may not be an obsession because it isn't ego dishonored, you know, it may make sense to them, but it is a rumination. And you can treat those ruminations like you would with OCD. You can set up a wallow time and then put it away and move on. Because there are some questions that are never answered. I mean, you can't answer, well, what if I had done, you know, if I hadn't, if the girl didn't go to that movie, you know, if we hadn't invited her to the movies, or if we hadn't gone to the movie, it wouldn't have happened. I feel, and honestly, I didn't know him well, so I never spoke to him, but I feel horrible for the driver. Can you imagine? 16. He was a good kid. You know, it was winter, it was an icy road. They were probably all laughing, who knows, but he skidded. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, there's no, you know, I hope he got, I think he had a good support system, so I hope he got some help with dealing with that. There's no, you know, you can't make that go away. It happened. But he also, he's 16. He also has a whole life ahead of him to lead. Luckily, I do know the girl's family, and they were absolutely, you know, everybody understood that it was an accident, and, you know, nobody was putting, I'm sure he felt enough guilt, but the family was not, like, laying that on him, but, so, you also need situation, you know, actual exposure to the places and things that the person's avoiding. So going out and you know, it could be pictures, it could be doing things that you used to do with the person. Again, in small doses, but if you'd always go listen to a certain kind of music, ultimately they're going to need to, you know, listen to that music. The people that they used to, I mean, things aren't going to be the same. You're socialized, nothing, things are different, but you may need, they may need to do some exposure before they really feel like doing it. Not maybe the first day, but gradually play golf, and we're working up towards music, because he didn't really play golf with my 69-year-old. He didn't really play golf with his wife, but he did the social thing after, and you know, gradually build up to at least, you know, at least trying, at least doing an experiment to see what does it feel like to talk to some of those people, to call some of those people, to be out and about. Then you really need to move on to, you know, the people have the question, what does life mean anymore? If they're having a challenge to their spiritual, to their faith, I can't answer that. I mean, I think if they're involved in a religion, I mean, if there's a good person, you know, a person they could talk to about their faith, I mean, the fact is that lots of people with spiritual lives have losses, and that I can help them, give them permission, try to help them make connections to talk to somebody. I don't do the spiritual piece. There are some counselors who, you know, are religious counselors that can do both. If that's something that the person needs to figure, I mean, you know, some good questions. How could God let that happen? Well, not an unusual question to have. That we can, you know, we can help them to find some places. And then they're going to need, ultimately, you want to help them move, find ways to move towards the future. Okay? The balance is, and what are their goals? How can they imagine, how can they go on? What will life be like? What do they want for themselves? They could, and again, that's something you can do in many different ways. You can have them write a letter to encourage someone else who's in a similar situation, or write a letter to the person you might be in 5 years. You know, write a letter to your first future self about, you know, look at, okay, what could life be like without this person? And what do you want for yourself without this person? You know, things like you can say, if I could magically make your grief at least manageable, what could you see yourself doing? What would you like for yourself? Certainly you want to help the person make use of their support system. Social interaction, I mean, social support is huge in grief. But be careful, because other people might be grieving differently, and you have to deal with that if that's the case. And people say the wrong thing. I find that actually a big loss shakes up an entire social network, and people are often very surprised. They find that someone they thought was their best friend can't deal with it and is unavailable. And someone that they only knew peripherally really is there for them. And that's something that we can, you know, help them look at and come to terms with. I stay away from, you know, I mean, they might have thoughts, well, but she never cared, or, you know, we don't know that. People have, it's awkward. What do you, people don't know what to say. I mean, it's really a problem. It is uncomfortable for, I mean, you could feel like, well, I'm the one with the loss, but it's like, other people, I mean, you want to be helpful. What can, you know, there's not much to say. The simple is the best. I have personally, you might find this hard to believe, but before I really had, you know, done much with grief myself, I remember saying some pretty damn stupid things that just didn't, I was trying to be well-meaning or helpful or whatever, and it was like, psh. So I have said some things in the past that I wasn't very proud of. Did you have a question, Tanya?
No, I just want to elaborate on it. I know when my niece passed away, and you know how people say sorry for your loss. When you're going through that, there's a lot of times you don't want to hear that. And I know when going through therapy and stuff, and when people would come in and say that to me, it was really weird because I can relate to that. So I could understand why they felt that way, or why, because you're grief, you don't want to hear that. It's like, that's final. When you say final for your loss, sorry for your loss, you know that's final. You're not ready to deal with that.
That's the thing. And, but it's very hard if you think about it, because also everyone grieves differently.
Right.
So for somebody else, that might be just what they want to hear. You know, and so for yourself, Tanji, now, at that point, what would you have wanted to hear?
I would have rather for you not to say anything.
Okay, would you have wanted a hug?
No.
Shut up.
But not so much shut up. I'm at that time when it happened, we were so devastated because it was a shock to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't want to deal with it at that point, at that moment. So I didn't want to hear sorry for your loss. I didn't want no hugs. I didn't want anything, because I needed to process what had just happened.
And the thing is that people, I think a lot of people are very awkward because they know, see, deep down, we know there's nothing we can say, okay? There is nothing. I mean, and people don't like feeling like they can't help. I mean, they really don't like, it's not on the same level as the person who's had the loss, but when people aren't there, it's partly, you know, you don't know why. It could be that they couldn't care less or they're egocentric, but often it really is that they don't want to say the wrong thing. They feel like they don't know how to help. I think, again, there are a lot of cultures that are actually, like, there's the whole casserole culture, which is, the whole food culture around loss. I mean, the truth is, when people are dealing, they don't want necessarily want to eat. On the other hand, they don't want to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but even then, you don't know, because people could be like, I don't want to eat. And then I do have one friend whose husband died suddenly went to work, healed over at 51. And she ended up, and she said to me, because she could still have a sense, the wife said, she had a sense of humor. She said, you know, I have a freezer full of lasagna, and I just wish somebody made something other than lasagna. But she got the point that people were trying to be helpful, and I know some people do, especially if there's an extended illness. Now they have, you can sign up online and say what you're cooking, and, you know, I mean, some of that's really nice, because then, but the truth is, there is nothing to say.
Yeah.
But you need to help people if they're feeling socially isolated, feeling like people have let them down. those are some kind of thoughts that you need to help them with, because staying social, it's, again, it's that in and out. You need some time to process. But if you go a year without social contact, that's a problem. And that's not going to help you get move on. And so you can help people with, and people get very, very angry at how somebody else didn't do this or didn't and said something stupid. And what?
That's true. That is mm-hmm. true. Especially in a family.
Oh.
Did you see Aunt Mary? I
yes.
can't believe she came with that clothing and that kind of stuff. And you're thinking,
that's right.
Well, I know this has something to do with the grieving, but how do you relate with that? That's just, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I said dispositioning the
sadness, the
anger, because I have a client who had the same issue. Their sister did that, you know, that's all she was doing.
And some of that could be, then they could end up ruminating about it, and again, it's like, so then you can, you know, again, when you get to that point in the therapy, you can help them look at, you know, what they want to do with those thoughts and feelings. Is, you know, if they're going to ruminate, does it need to be in a wallow time? Do they really want to get rid of all their friends because nobody handled it just the way they wanted? And when, I think Tanji, let's face it, she's a mental health professional. She's in touch with, not everybody knows. The truth is, there probably was nothing they wanted to hear at that point. Because if you ask people, well, what would you have liked? There's nothing. What can you say? I can't believe, okay, this is one of my things, but I can't believe when people put a major loss on Facebook and then they have, I have never been able to do that at all. I don't want to read 37 people saying sorry for your loss or, you know, I'm so.
Yeah.
I feel like if someone posts it, they're probably asking for that. And then I do try to respond. I mean, I feel like I should say something, but I couldn't. I mean, I never. You know, it just doesn't feel like the avenue to me. If I'm going to talk to somebody about it, it's going to be in a different venue. But that, you know, again, people get their support in different ways, but. The truth is that often when you're upset afterwards about how so-and-so handled it or what he did or what she did, there wasn't the right thing to do. And we don't know why people are that way. But some people do find they make much, you know, the people who do hit what they need at the right time become really close friends. And somebody who wasn't that close a friend could become much closer. Because they provided what the person needed at that time. I do know the woman who, it's interesting, the woman whose son, adult son, killed himself, she needed to talk about it. And, you know, we were trying to find more venues, you know, because she couldn't talk about it with her husband. And so she tried going to a group of people, of parents, or people who, suicide survivors group. And boy, did she, you know, again, timing is everything. She hated that. Who the hell wants to hear about their stories? You know, she had enough problem with her own. And so for her, now other people find it's very supportive to hear other people. So there isn't one answer. But people may, you know, people don't get it, and you know, you have to decide if you want to rule them out. That actually brings me to page 8, where this is a hospice group's Bill of Rights for, you know, you have some rights. Now, the thing is, not everybody is going to be able to provide what you need, but you know, you're going to experience your own unique grief. You may need to talk about it. You're going to have feelings. You may have limits. You may have attacks out of nowhere. Ritual is a wonderful thing. I think a lot of people find ritual helpful. If the person doesn't have a if they don't have built-in religious or cultural rituals, I often help people make their own rituals. You know, and you don't need a culture or a religion to tell you, you know, what could you do to commemorate, to feel like you were connecting, you know, have a ceremony of some kind that's comforting to you. So ritual can be very helpful. And people will say everything, you know, people will say the wrong thing. That's what we're there to try to help, you know, balance that. And it's like, yeah, that wasn't, you know, that person didn't say the right thing. They might have been trying to help. But you may need to search for meaning and look at, and people will say things. Do they feel like they'll say it was God's will? People tend to not want to hear that, even if that's what you believe in your religion. But we're not going to stop people saying the wrong thing. We can try not to say the wrong thing. So, obviously, it's stressful. You might have to talk to your people, you know, help your people with basic self-care. Are they eating? That's one of the things I always ask, you know, are you eating? Are you sleeping? You know, are you taking care of yourself? Relaxation, mindfulness meditation, learning about mindfulness can be very helpful because people do need to be taking care of themselves. Just briefly about kids, okay? Kids, again, they have their own separate ways, and it can be very hard, depending on their age, for them to understand what this means. Not people try to spare. Why do people do this? People try to spare children from feelings. They think kids don't know when the parents are going to get a divorce and they're fighting and angry and tense all the time, so nobody talks about it. Yeah. I remember I heard of a little girl whose parents, you know, I mean, it was a nasty, nasty marriage and whatever, and the parents kept talking about divorce, and the little girl, I don't know how old she was young, and so she went up to her daddy and she said, "So, if you guys get divorced, you know, you'll be my ex-daddy." And everyone laughed. They thought that was hysterical. They told the story. They thought it was so cute.
Oh God!
And she was devastated. I mean, that's what she understood. That now her family was breaking up, and she would have, you know, her mommy and her ex-daddy. And people, again, each person's different, but to not talk about a death or a loss, it's just like, then there's no opportunity. It's not like the kid's not going to know what's going on in the household. If everyone's crying, everybody's upset. So there's kind of, you know, you want to simplify and just talk about, so who died, what's going on, what are people, you know, whether both parents and kids need to understand what is grief. I mean, the kids are like, why am I feeling this way, right? They don't understand. Why are they sad? And luckily, there are some wonderful age-appropriate books. You can... do drawings and have them, you know, talk about their memories. You can see, you know, talk with them if they want to. If they say, I don't want, you know, if they're saying, I don't want to talk about it, you want to leave the door open, you know, and you say, it's sad. It's very sad to talk about it, but at some point, it's a good idea. Again, you help them in their own simple way go in and out, you know. Sometimes you're going to think about it. Talking about, other people's grief. There are some beautiful, I remember centuries ago. God, a lot of things happened centuries ago. But when my kids were very young, I think my daughter was 4, and her uncle was diagnosed with AIDS. Okay? And at the time, this was very new. Okay? And we figured he would be, you know, he was going to die. And so we're like, okay, we're going to figure out how to deal with the whole concept of death with young children, you know? And there were some beautiful, beautiful books. We did all this great stuff, and the guy's still going strong. You know, it didn't hurt them at all. But then it was interesting because talking to, my kid actually, this came up recently with my daughter. She remembers being in Boston Market, and we were trying to explain and talking about being gay and having AIDS in, you know, to a 4-year-old. And, you know, she was, like, loudly in Boston Market saying, I don't see what the problem is. I'm going to marry Greta, and she's a girl, you know. It's like, you know, and talking about, you know, her uncle dying and stuff in public places because, you know, and she still remembers that. She didn't marry Greta, but, you know, the kids didn't think it was much of a big deal. But there are some beautiful, beautiful books and, you know, ways to just, it's easier, especially, you know, to talk about it in terms of other people. You know, it doesn't have to be about their grandma or whoever. And then time, you know, if they have, the kids are, I find kids are much more open than adults often because they don't have the layers of garbage. And they can, you know, they might want to preserve some memories. They can write stories. If they don't write, they can tell you stories. I love doing this with young kids where they tell the story and I write it down and they have a book. You know, you can make a book about grandma and what you treasure. You can draw pictures of grandma. You can help a kid have their own special memorial service, you know, where they read a poem or share a memory, and it could be just for them and just for the two of you or include the family. Pay attention to anniversaries and holidays because kids are going to tell you what they need if you let them. But if they get the messages that it's not okay to talk about it, or if mom, so many parents go cry behind closed doors, and, you know, I mean, you don't want to, yes, it's going to be upsetting if you spend all day sobbing and can't function as a mom, you know, that's going to freak the kid out. But to cry and say, you know, I'm feeling sad because grandma died. What's wrong? I mean, people feel like that's not okay. Just like they feel like they can't show anger in front of their parents. Again, if you're beating each other up, that's not a good idea. But people have fights and people get sad. So, there are lots of, if you look it up, there's all kinds of cool kid interventions, which, to be honest, I like using kid interventions with adults. I really do. Drawing pictures. One I like where, you know, because if the kids say, I don't want to feel sad, but then they're also showing signs that they're, you know, not dealing well and they're not functioning, you can draw a picture of a wall and you can have, show that by keeping out the pain and the sadness, they're also keeping out the happy memories and the love and the good feelings, you know, and you can, so how, you know, we need, so if we just make a little, take a break out of the wall and let some of the good feelings come in, some of the bad feelings will come in, but that's, you know, you can handle them. You know, you can do, I think adults often need basics. And so I like kid interventions with adults. I love the charts, you know, with faces of all the different emotions. We have them all over our office. All kinds of adults are fascinated by those pictures and are like, wait, is that really what disgust looks like? You know, I mean, and we don't ever really grow up. And then, again, they need some help moving on and not, you know, some of each, some of the grief, but also looking at, okay, what are they doing for fun? What are they doing? Can they remember, you know, can they remember grandma or whoever? I mean, it could be a parent, it could be a sibling, it could be, can they remember and still love the person who died, but also have the relationships with other people in their life now and get that okay? If you're finding that the problematic grief is still, not that they're, with kids or adults, not that grief is going to be gone, but if it's still being equally problematic, you want to ask yourself, you know, are they really facing their thoughts and feelings? Is there some piece they're still avoiding? Do they want, when you talk to people, what would it mean if you were less absorbed by this grief? That's going to open up. There are a lot of people who feel like if I get over this, it means I didn't care. What's the downside of moving forward? It's always a good idea to talk about. There's a downside to every change, and even health is a, being healthy has its drawbacks. But, you know, if they get over it and move on with life, what does that mean? And I'm going to take a break, and then I'm going to talk about guilt, which is one of my, I don't know, I love dealing with guilt, because I feel like guilt is one of these emotions that it actually ends up not serving any. Most emotions, you need to have some, and they, you know, it serves a useful purpose. But guilt is, I think, wonderful, because it's almost always dysfunctional, and it's a good one to take. So we're going to talk about guilt, and then I think we're going to have some time to do Tanji's case and any other consultation you want before. And then, what, are you people speaking out?
No, I'm not.
No.
Are you also going to talk about shame as well?
I am. Just,
With grief?
Or
yeah.
Guilt?
Yeah, guilt with
sometimes
shame. Shame would be very helpful.
Yeah, I took a whole, oh God, it's just, I had a flashback just, and I took a really hard course in Glasgow Cub, and there's a book, oh God, it was so deep, Shame and Guilt in Neurosis.
I just had
a flashback, because that is a big, big topic, but we'll see, we'll do what we can.